doesn't know who where and for what priority. There's no way you find.
Chapter 1. Why the EBC&B? For a few weeks in the late 1960s, the most glamorous place in Britain was Leicester Forest East Service Station, a newly constructed part of Harold Wilson's white-hot technological revolution. The restaurant interiors were designed by the achingly fashionable Terence Conran. It wasn't as cool by the mid-80s when I started going there. I was having my year off between school and college, though I had very little intention of going to college. I'd signed on to the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, and my plan was to be a pop star. So I was living at home with Mum and Dad, playing the occasional gig with the band, Whiz for Atoms, and going to lots of practices. This generally added up to a lot of lying in very late and a lot of going to bed very late. The only place in the entire East Midlands open at these unsociable hours was Leicester Forest East. I'd sit, watch the traffic go by, pretend to be a tragically romantic figure by reading a difficult book, and I'd order one of their standard set breakfasts, egg, bacon, chips and beans. And gradually, without me noticing, egg, bacon, chips and beans became my order. It became part of my identity. A small part, I'm not a nutter. It became part of how I dwelt on the land, to get all Hopi Indian about it. Which brings me closer to the reason for this book. There's nothing more nourishing and affirming than a good fry-up. It fills you up in so many ways. It fills your nose with that irresistible bacon aroma. It fills your plate with an overflowing of bounty. No plate can really hold a decent fry-up. Clearly, it's good, honest, down-to-earth food. Nothing fancy here. But there's depth and nuance to this stuff. No chip is quite like another chip. Never the same combination of crunchy and smooth. No two eggs are ever fried in precisely the same way. Different amounts of crispy burntness. Different whites, different yellows. Beans are never just beans. Bacon. Well, what can you say about bacon? Bacon is the uber food, the food. Bacon is the alpha and omega. Bacon is quite nice. Bacon is proof of the existence of God. A great cafe, meanwhile, makes you think and ponder and imagine. You sit in the cafe and dream idle little dreams and think flighty little thoughts. You speculate and postulate, and sooner or later, you think maybe you'd like to start recording some of these thoughts. So, sometime in the early 21st century, I wrote my first entry on my website, eggbaconchipsandbeans.com. It was some pictures of the Blandford Cafe in London and some little comments. I felt that some great cafes weren't getting the attention they deserved. Pop culture had gone all foodie and pretentious, and everyday food and the people who made it were being ignored. And there's something very definitively British about the cafe experience. Like so many of the voyages on which I've embarked, this should have just fizzled out pathetically once I got bored. But it didn't. I began to get decent amounts of web traffic. Not huge amounts, it's not pornography, but it did okay. People began visiting the site and posting nice comments and recommending places I should visit. I'd stumbled onto a culture that people had real affection for. The amount of comments I got from outside the UK suggested it was something that made people homesick and nostalgic. And then I won a prize from Yahoo, the website people who love exclamation marks. They'd voted the site one of the top 10 in the country, and a flurry of press articles couldn't resist leading with large pictures of fried food from the website. And I suddenly got tons and tons of traffic, including quite a few publishers, and I got a chance to write the book. Notes on the writing of the book. I set myself a few rules for the project, just to make things more interesting and give it that self-satisfied ring of performance art. Rule 1. I'm only going to write about cafes I really like. Every cafe in this book is really good. It's easy to be funny about crap things, but there are enough crap books about crap things around, and I didn't want to contribute to the crappy Christmas tidal wave. So this is, obviously, not a definitive list of good cafes. There are loads of other good cafes out there. Equally, there are a lot of bad ones out there, but you'll have to find them for yourselves. And if you find a bad cafe, I can only apologise and urge you to try and find the good in it. Like Timothy Spall in Tom Cruise film, there's always a moment to celebrate. Rule 2. It's all a bit sly and surreptitious. The plan here is not to do glossy photography of glamorous interiors. This is not inspiration for your Docklands flat. I took most of the pictures myself with a cheap little digital camera, mostly from where I was sitting and eating. If you see a good photo, it was almost certainly taken by my mate Russell Duncan. Mine are just pictures of how these places actually are on a regular day. There are no arc lights, no stylists, no models. That should be obvious from looking at the pictures. A major reason for all this surreptitious behaviour is that a lot of people don't like you taking pictures in cafes, particularly the clientele. A lot of people have probably assumed I'm from the Department of Work and Pensions or the Child Support Agency or some kind of UFO investigation squad. Rule 3. Don't get too obsessive about it. They're only cafes. I seldom went out of my way to find these places. They were places that just came along as I lived my life. Consequently, you'll probably see evidence of my life in the pictures. You'll see the egg and chips that my lovely wife Anne often orders, or the Star Wars and Playmobil characters my son Arthur often brings with him. The only exceptions to this find them where you find them rule were two big trips I made to look for cafes that were a little beyond London and the East Midlands. Two big road trips involving many cafes in a few days. I can recommend it. Rule 4, don't talk about Fight Club. Rule 5, there is no Rule 5. There's no Rule 4. Sorry, I'll do that bit again. Rule 5, there is no Rule 5. There's no Rule 4, really. That was just a joke. There are only 3 rules. So that's it. Intro over. On with the book. But first, a note on nomenclature. Café, with the accent, is just too fancy. Cafés are already overburdened with spelling requirements, so it seems unfair to throw an accent in there as well. And it takes the whole thing just a little too far upmarket. A good café is too unpretentious for an accent. Caf, though, is going too far the other way. It smacks too much of slumming it, of crass tourism. Class tourism. It sounds like a bit like rugby players getting into footy. I think it's occasionally acceptable to say it, but it's demeaning to cafe owners to write it all the time. Cafe, no accent, is just right. It's how you normally see the word written. It feels right to give them the credit of that final syllable, but it seems proper and British to drop the accent. Chapter 2. Let's go to work on an egg. For years and years, I never had breakfast. It probably started at college, where I spent most of the time in bed and was never up in time for breakfast. And then, starting work, I was always too miserable in the morning to eat anything. So for years and years, I never had breakfast. And my life was as an aching void. Then a few years back, during one of those periodic bursts of must-change-my-lifeness that everyone gets, I decided I had to have breakfast. I'd read in a book that it was a good idea. So being lazy and against cooking, I turned to the cafes of old London town to sate my breakfast appetites. And my life was as a joyful noise. I discovered the truth and power of that old go-to-work-on-an-egg slogan. A truth and power which would only have been enhanced if whoever wrote it could have made something pithy out of go-to-work-on-an-egg with some bacon, chips and beans. A cafe breakfast sets you up incredibly well for the day ahead. It's not just a truckload of calories, it's the space you carve out for planning and thinking and being yourself. As a Californian might say, it's a good time to take a deep swim in Lake Hugh. And we need that me time when so much of everyone else's time is crowded with impossible decisions about work-life balance. This all points to an important conceptual leap you have to make if you're going to embrace the EBCB and live your life the EBCB way, soon to be a major series of advisory pamphlets. You have to start thinking about fry-ups differently. To some people, a fry-up is just a cheap meal, grabbed quickly, unregarded. To we few but happy EBCB samurai, it's something else. It's a spiritual sanctuary. It's a planning session akin to Churchill's gatherings in the war room. It's the Algonquin round table, even if you're there on your own. It's a time to make elaborate romantic plans or deduce things from articles in the paper. It's the calm before the storm, the pre-match meal, the screw your courage to the sticking place thingy. It's the place and time where your life finds its centre, its meaning, its purpose, and its vision. And then you go to work. Chapter 3. The chicken is involved, the pig is committed. During the run-up to the first Gulf War, the Gulf War to end all Gulf Wars, General Norman Schwarzkopf was apparently asked what he meant by saying that the US forces were involved but not committed. He replied that if you think about a nice plate of bacon and egg, then the chicken is involved but the pig is committed. I like that notion, and I think it's as true of this book as it is of Gulf War analogies. Lots of pigs have been harmed in the manufacture of this book, but the worst that's happened to chickens is all the horrible stuff that free-range people tell you they don't do. And that's why bacon is preceding eggs in this book, if not in its title. Bacon drives vegetarians mad. It's the food they always go on about. It's the thing that finally breaks them. Why? Because it's absolutely bloody delicious, and it's not a vegetable. So ha to all you vegetarians. Your choice may be ethically and nutritionally admirable, but it's tastefully inferior. A poll conducted by DanePack found that 39% of the British population felt their Monday mornings would be made more cheerful by the inclusion of a bacon roll, and that 37% think a bacon butty improves their mood, and that 17% would rather have a bacon butty every day than make love every day. Another poll found that the three most popular smells in the UK are baked bread, bacon and coffee, in that order. So you can see why a bacon roll and a coffee is such a popular choice when people need cheering up. That simple single meal combination provides the three most popular smells in the country. It doesn't seem much, but think how hard that is to do. If you combine the three most popular colours in the world, you just end up with brown. But the three most popular smells? They come together in a taste sensation that staves off depression, can cost less than £2, and gets you through the first unpleasant status meeting of the day. Could that be why we eat 450,000 tonnes of bacon a year? More than any other country in Europe. That's a lot of bacon. If we wanted to launch all that bacon into space instead, we'd need around 65,000 Soyuz rockets or 120,000 space shuttles. And all that bacon cost us £430 million. You could buy a couple of Chelsea footballers with that. Of course, pigs give us much more than bacon, by which I don't mean they gave us viaducts and the Pre-Raphaelites, but there's so much that a pig is absolutely delicious. Grimond de la Reynière, who was apparently the very first restaurant critic, put it best when he said that the pig is an encyclopedic animal. It is a veritable meal on hooves. One throws away nothing. Though we mustn't get too carried away with this sentimental tosh. Baden-Powell really enjoyed the noble sport of pig-sticking, describing it as a glorious pursuit with a good weapon in your hand of an enemy whom you want to kill. That's very much how I think of a lovely piece of well-fried bacon. Chapter 4, I think. A common thing done uncommonly well. H.J. Hines said his aim in life was simply to do a common thing uncommonly well. Isn't that nice? Isn't that a perfect way to look at life? Doesn't that perfectly sum up what a good baked bean is all about? Especially a Heinz baked bean. Heinz beans are definitely a common thing. They sidle into every aspect of our lives. They're the perfect childhood comfort food. They keep students alive during the long winter months when beer alone doesn't provide sufficient calories. They're the perfect antidote to a cold and dismal afternoon watching your team getting relegated. They're an essential component in any British home. And of course, they're American. And Heinz do beans uncommonly well. Let me count the ways. 1. They disguise their vegetable roots with great aplomb. The orange thing in the tin seems so far removed from the idea of a bean that it never crosses children's minds to reject it on vegetable grounds. And it doesn't even taste like a vegetable. It doesn't have that self-satisfied fibrous crunch. Instead, a good baked bean has the yieldy, meaty feel of an incredibly tender snake. And even better, an 80-gram portion of beans apparently counts as one of the 5 portions of fruit and vegetables you're supposed to have every day. Add a grilled tomato to your EBCB and you're well on your way to a healthy lifestyle. 2. They're orange. Genius. Who'd thought of making food orange? Apart from oranges, obviously. And no one thought of that. That was God. Or evolution. Or both. Such a rare burst of optimistic colour on the miserable post-war British culinary scene. Grey potatoes, grey meat, grey peas, and then open the tin and here comes the orangeness. Marvellous. No wonder everyone fell in love. And no wonder subsequent child-oriented food inventions have tended to be orange. Fish fingers? Why are they orange? It's not because cod are orange. It's because of baked beans. Then they go and do the common thing even more uncommonly well by making the tin that particular bluish colour, which makes the beans look even better. 3. You don't have to cook them. How good is that? A foodstuff that tastes marvellous when piping hot, but that you can eat perfectly well when stone cold. Out of the tin, with your hands, lying on the kitchen floor because you're too drunk to stand. That's versatile. That is a high quality foodstuff. 4. They're personalisable. Every tin of beans is the same. They're consistently delicious. But as soon as they hit the pan, the personality of the cook takes over. You can never cook beans badly, see point 3 above. But you can cook them in your own individual way. How much heat? How long? Simmering or blasting? How much juice do you boil off? Do you aim for that gooey green bean paste? Blech. Do you aim for that gooey bean paste so many people like? Or do you strive to preserve the individuality of each bean? It's up to you. The bean allows you to really express yourself, to speak of who you are, to be all you can be. To bean all you can bean. 5. They last forever in those neat little tins. They'll survive the collapse of the planet, the meltdown of the sun, and the long, slow, entropic death of the universe. This is how the world ends. Not with a bang, but with insectoid and apocalypse survivors trying to open a can of beans. They have the best slogan. 6, this is. Beans means Heinz. It's the best advertising slogan ever, and was officially recognised as such in 2000 by the Advertising Slogan Hall of Fame. It's good firstly because it's memorable, it's got that little internal rhyme and that quirky spelling which means it instantly sticks in your head. It's also good because it claims the generic. It doesn't try and tell you that Heinz beans are better in some way, it just says that Heinz beans are the very definition of beans. There is no other sort of beans. If the beans aren't Heinz, then they're not really beans. That's clever. There is actually some dispute who actually wrote Beans Means Heinz. The acknowledged author was Maurice Drake, who apparently wrote the line in a pub in 1967. But recently a Mr. Jeff Bennett has emerged, claiming he wrote the line 10 years earlier as part of a Heinz competition which netted him a shopping trip to Hamleys. He's not bitter about it though, and is keen to dissociate himself from the misspelling that Drake came up with, which of course is most of the genius of the idea. Oh well. Point 7 on beans. They're top secret. Apparently only 4 people know the secret baked beans recipe. Doesn't that lend them a little note of extra glamour? They're almost quite sexy now, you know that. Chapter 5, maybe? The duality of eggs. Here are the 2 things. 1. Eggs are funny. Eggs are funny food. Throw a brick and it's terrorism. Throw an egg and it's comedy. Burn a book and it's fascism. Burn an egg and it's cookery. Cabbages were once considered comedy items, but since it's become well known that the sound effects of punches to the head in Raging Bull were created by hitting cabbages, they've become more sinister. They look funny to start with. Round things are funnier than angular things. 8, for instance, is a funnier number than 4. And eggs are more funny because they're not spherical. They're a bit distorted. They're, well, egg-shaped. They don't roll properly. They topple. They need to go in a cup. They're odd. They're Humpty Dumpty. They're funny. And the word is funny. Egg. It's just funny to say. Imagine Rowan Atkinson as Edmund Blackander saying it. Egg. Eggy. Egg-bound. It's funny. It's not an obvious comedy word like knob or kipper. It's not slightly sexual. It's funny because of the sound and the image it conjures up. Thing 2. Eggs are boring. For some strange reason, eggs attract pedants. They attract the people who are always trying to tell you exactly how things should be done. It's bizarre but true. Open any cookbook and you'll find they always start with detailed advice on how to cook the perfect egg. They start with the perfect boiled egg, then on to the perfect scrambled egg, and then at some point presumably end up with instructions for the perfect coddled egg or on a bed of something. All their methods for attaining perfection demand strict adherence to detailed instructions about boiling duration, freshness of egg, pinches of salt, alignment of stars, and menstrual cycles of participants. Sometimes it's 3.5 minutes, sometimes it's 4. But everything is about finding perfection in something that is essentially completely unknowable. An egg is an organic object, not a reagent bottle, and every egg is different in chemical composition, in the amount it was shaken up and down on the way back from the shops. Yet these pedants insist on a striving for perfection. The best example of this vicious egg pedantry is probably the leading bore of the 21st century, James Bond. Sorry, that should be 20th century, James Bond. Ian Fleming's books are full of detailed description of how Bond liked his eggs. Boiled for 3.5 minutes, must be brown, must be from French Marin's hens, must be very fresh. This just gives you one more reason not to sit next to Bond at a dinner party. If he's not going on about the cars he's driven, the women he's slept with or the gadgets he owns, he'll be bending your ear about eggs. Avoid him. And don't ever go to a cafe with him. Chapter 6. More eggs. Eggs and the tyranny of choice. The great thing about cafes is the limited amount of choice. That's what set breakfasts are for. They narrow your culinary universe into understandable clumps. You look for an acceptable solution to your foodie need state. You don't push for perfection, and everyone's happy. In fact, this is one of the hardships about ordering egg, bacon, chips and beans. Although it has its own mythic origins as a set meal at Leicester Forest East, see intro, It's not often a standard British combination, so ordering it can be a trial. Typically, a request for an EBCB is at first met with a worrying pause as the cafe representative mentally processes a deviant food request and you wait nervously to see if it's deemed an acceptable order. Then, with an almost imperceptible sigh, the much-chewed biro is dragged across the scrappy paper of the order pad, scrawling something like sausage, egg and chips. You and ahm incisively and say, no, sorry, actually bacon, please, and chips and beans. Peas, they say. No, beans. Okay, drink. Tea, please. Coffee. No, tea. Okay, take a seat. This should be regarded as a good transaction. All the items are available. There have been no tears, no fighting, and not too much embarrassment. My favourite scenario is always the shout back. You state your order and the person serving you merely shouts it back to the kitchen and the food arrives a few moments later with nothing ever being written down. Then when you go and pay, you remind the server what you had and he or she makes up a price to charge you. I love that. It's a kind of post-literate improvised theatre. So, let's go back to choice and let's look at the world capital of choice, the Ottoman Empire of options, the average American cafe diner. Now I have to say, I adore these places. They're sumptuous palaces of sustained pleasure. The graphics are always gorgeous, the food is always generous, the people are always lovely. I think those years of watching Happy Days after school and Saved by the Bell after work have conditioned me to appreciate a diner like Pavlov's dogs appreciate Big Ben. If you need proof of my enthusiasm, then consider the fact in the 5 years I spent in the States, I gained 3 stone and it wasn't all muscle. Nevertheless, I have to admit that the choices they offer you are always terrifying. Then you notice that no one around you seems to be even looking at the menu. They seem to just be deciding what they want to have and then just ordering it. Almost instantly, you have to order a drink, and while you're doing it, some glasses of water arrive. And you're not sure whether they're someone else's order or what, but you try to ignore that and you order a cup of tea. And then you have to choose what kind of tea, because they don't do generic tea like cafes do. Then you have to choose between lemon and tea and milk, and then they go away and leave you for a while. Breathe. Just breathe. Then they're back and you order some tasty sounding combination of fried stuff and you think you're okay for a minute, but then comes the moment of truth, the egg question. You cannot believe the amount of egg choice you have. Scrambled, soft-boiled, hard-boiled, coddled, fried, poached, basted. And of course you can often opt to just have the whites or demand eggs high in omega-3s or request that the eggs be rotated widdershins before a conclave of cardinals while being cooked by the magnificent light from Alta Centauri. For ages I'd always opt for scrambled because I learned that thing led to the thing you always want, no further questions. Whereas opting for fried always led to the question of how you wanted it, and I just didn't know. What's sunny side up? What's over easy? Does it make that much difference? That's why I so love the British cafe. I've ordered a lot of fried eggs in a lot of cafes, and no one has ever asked me how I'd like that cooked. As long as it's actually cooked, I'm not bothered how. Chapter 7. What do you expect for £4? Every now and then I'll recommend a cafe to someone and they'll come back and complain that the food was no good. Sure, it was friendly and clean, but actually the quality of the cooking wasn't that high. This always puzzles me. It seems to be missing the point somehow. What do they expect for £4? I once got told this hoary old story set in the world of advertising. It's probably told in all kinds of professions, but it's a useful idea. And it definitely applies to cafes. A client once marched in to see an ad man and demanded that his new ads be done at great speed, at hugely reduced cost, and that they be much better than they used to be. The advertising man sighed, drew a triangle on a bit of paper and wrote 3 words, one at each corner. The words were fast and good and cheap. And he simply said to the client, pick two. I realise now that I've written that like a joke with some kind of punchline. Sorry if you were expecting a laugh, but instead you got something much better. You've got a point, and it's a valuable point. You can very rarely get something that's good and fast and cheap. You can have fast and good, but not cheap, or good and cheap, but not fast, or, well, you can see where this is going. And that's worth bearing in mind when it comes to cafes. They all tend to offer fast and cheap, so if you get good as well, then you're very lucky. Or you're basing your lifestyle on this book, because every cafe in here delivers on fast and cheap and good. Except for the odd one, like the old Smithy, that doesn't do dead cheap, but actually does top quality food. Chapter 8. Crispness and softness. Chips are extraordinarily, remarkably delicious. One of the most compelling and bewitching substances known to man. It's such a beautiful thing, and perhaps evidence of the existence of God, that the humble, tedious potato can be transformed, by the simple addition of heat and fat, into this delightful piece of sensory heaven. And that's a mystical process yet to be adequately explained by human science. Let's face it, if fat and heat normally made for bewitching beauty, the beaches of Benidorm would be very different places. This alchemy is all the more magical because the potato is such an unremarkable beast, so easy to overlook. The Spanish first found them in the Andes around 1537 and had no idea what a versatile, efficient food they'd found. They didn't bring any back to Spain for another 70 years, and even then it was probably just a diverting trifle, the 16th century equivalent of the amusement-shaped vegetables on that life. However, you don't need me just telling you that chips are delicious, you know that. What you want is a detailed and rigorous analysis of the role of the chip in the complex culinary cultural construct that is the EBCB. Don't you? You don't? Then you're reading the wrong book, pal. Can I perhaps refer you to one of my esteemed colleagues in the Real Books About Stuff That Matters section? So let's think about that for a minute, and let's see if we can squeeze in any torturous analogies with pompous rock ensembles. You imagine your EBCB is made up of the members of Queen. Roger Taylor, the drummer, is your bacon. Essential. Gotta have it. Makes a difference if it's bad, but even brilliant drumming, or bacon, will only get you so far. You can appreciate a drum solo for about 30 seconds. After that, it goes rapidly downhill. Likewise, a meal that's entirely bacon. I know, I've tried the Atkins diet. John Deacon, the bassist, is your beans. Again, essential. Again, it's got to be right. But it's hard to screw it up, and even a magnificent contribution is only so good. Brian May, the guitarist and Anita Dobson's spouse and lookalike, is the egg. It's a bit flashy, it can do a lot of different things, and for a while it can make a real difference. But it can't sustain your attention for long. Man cannot live on eggs alone. I know, I've tried the Atkins diet. But Freddie Mercury is the chips, or was. He made the difference. He made them sound like Queen. Queen with George Michael sounded mostly like George Michael. Queen with that new old bloke from Free just sound like a band with some bloke from Free. The chips make the difference. That's the first essential law of chip contribution to the EBCB experience. Chips add variety. Chips make the difference. Chips help you tell one from another. And with familiarity and practice, you'll soon be able to work out where you are if you're ever kidnapped, held in a darkened room and fed fry-ups from a local cafe. So it's worth taking the time to copy this chapter onto rice paper and secrete it in your underwear. Why chips are nice. A quote from The Primal Cheeseburger by Elizabeth Rosin. The French fry, properly executed, perhaps provides an ideal interaction between substance, starch, medium, fat or oil, and technique, high heat immersion, resulting in a product that is uniform in all its sensory attributes. The characteristic flavour, aroma, colour and texture of fried foods that are so widely appealing. No intermediary coating or wrapping is required. Immersed in boiling oil or fat, properly sliced potatoes achieve the exemplary form of a deep-fried food. The outer surfaces are instantly sealed and slowly browned, with all the flavour, colour and crispness that fried starch provides, while the inside portion is cooked to a melting softness. The result offers the textural pleasure of crispness and softness in each golden bite.